listening to the podcast of Hillside Christian Fellowship. We hope and pray that you are encouraged by today's message.
Today I'd like to close out our walk through the Gospel of John. And I thought I'd just start out by kind of summarizing, you know, the Gospel itself stands alone. It's very different from the other three Gospels. And John's entire purpose in writing the Gospel, he says in chapter 20, I've written these things so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that in believing, what's the point of believing? The point of believing is that you might have life in his name. He came that we might have life and have that more abundantly. And so John's Gospel, his entire purpose in writing it, was to see to it that whoever heard his preaching of the good news would have a personal encounter with Jesus. His gospel, the stories that he chose, he said at the end, look, there are enough books in all the world to contain everything that Jesus said and did. It's just impossible. But these things he chose out of all the things Jesus did for the one purpose of making sure that we had an encounter with a living Jesus, that he is not a belief system. We didn't get born again, translated out of darkness into life so that we could just change how we think. That's a part of the gospel, isn't it? We're renewed in our mind. We're transformed that way. But that's not all that it is. Jesus didn't come just to pay a price on a cross so that we could have a ticket to eternal life and then just kind of make our way by for the remainder of our time here on earth. That's part of it, but that's not all of what Jesus came to do. In fact, all of the seven miracle stories that John told came with somebody approaching Jesus or Jesus approaching somebody thinking they were going to get one temporal need met. Whether it was a drink that they needed food, or they needed a miracle healing in their body, or whatever the case was, they'd come to Jesus or Jesus would come to them and he would meet that need, but he would always say, now let me meet the deeper need in your life. If you're willing, I have a lot more than this for you. I have a lot more than a drink that's going to satisfy your body. I am a well of living water. And if you really knew, he said to the woman at the well, who you're talking to, you'd be begging me to give you a drink of that and you'll never be thirsty again. I've got so much more. And John's gospel of all of them really brings out how much we can have as much of what Jesus gives to us as we're willing to receive. Or more accurately, what we're willing to press into. You recall the first two disciples who followed after Jesus after he came back from his wilderness 40 days. He'd been baptized and he came back to where John was baptizing. Two of John the Baptist's disciples began to follow Jesus. This is in John chapter 2. And Jesus turned to them after they were following him and he asked the eternal question that all of us have to answer. And he asked them, what do you seek? Which is a really good question and not as obvious as it might seem. Because people follow Jesus for all manner of reasons. Many people follow Jesus because he can meet my needs. He can satisfy my soul. He can give me eternal life. He can come and, you know, change everything about who I am and even my eternal destination. And that's one reason why people follow Jesus. Some people, as Jesus called out the crowds in Capernaum, are just looking for free food. Some people just want a miracle. Hey, I need my arm healed. I broke my arm. Where's Becca? I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. She's not even here for it. I broke my arm. I need it to be healed. Or I need something in my life done right now. And you see over and over again throughout the Gospels that sometimes Jesus would do that healing. And that's the last he ever saw that person. And why Jesus made the statement. So what's the point if somebody would gain the whole world? Gain everything that heaven could afford, but lose his soul in the process? The answer that those first two disciples gave is the only right answer. They basically said, you know, we don't even know what we're looking for. We just want to know where you live. Where are you? How is it, where could we go so that we could stay with you in this journey? And as soon as they answered that way, I could just about see a smile come across Jesus' face. He said, well, why don't you come and see? And with that, their lives were never the same again. Neither was the world the same again. And so all throughout the Gospel of John, we've seen how Jesus revealed himself as the one who meets every aspect of our being, body, soul, and spirit. He meets every need. But he's after something much more than just being the genie in the sky or Santa Claus or, push these three buttons, pull that lever, and cha-ching, you get God's promises that he came to restore the most important thing, the thing that God had in mind from the foundations of the world. He came to restore the family of God to himself. He came to bring sons and daughters back. One of the things that I love about being a father, how many of you know, all your parents can testify, there's certain ways that you call your children's name, right? And as a child, you learn by age 3 whether you want to go running to their parents' call or whether it's time to hide. So like if mom or dad uses your middle name, it's time to go run and hide. Stephen Lee Blair, my mother never did that actually like that. But, and there's a tone in the voice that when you hear your name called, I'm out of here. I'm busted. I don't even know which thing I got busted for, but I know I'm busted for something. And the last person I want to see is dad or, right now. Then there's another way that you can call your child's voice. And it's the simple, there's love communicated in that way. Hey, sweetheart. Taya, why don't you come on, sit on daddy's lap. It's time for a story. And the look, I know as a father, the delight of a father is to see that child respond and come sit up on your lap and savor those moments of snuggling before they get big like Labrador puppies and they don't fit on your lap anymore. But there's that moment that God called each and every one of us by name. And that moment is the reset button of our life. The moment, if you could even take yourself back right now. In fact, can we just do that for a moment? Take yourself back. When was the first time that you knew that God had personally called you by name? That somehow you knew it could have come through the words of the preacher, it could have come in the quietness of your desperate hour, it could have come by reading the Word of God, whatever way it came. How is it that God first penetrated through your stony heart and made you to know, he knows me, he gets me, he's called me by my name? I know exactly when it happened for me, and it was literally somebody remembering my name. I used to go to these retreat weekends called Teens Encounter Christ, and there was one man who helped run those things, Steve Perrone. And he was a great youth leader. This was a huge ministry. It covered all of Long Island. There were hundreds of kids involved. And sometimes we'd go out to it was an Episcopal church ministry. We'd go out to the cathedral for big youth events. So, hundreds of kids out on the lawn at this cathedral and we'd be there. Well, I'd been on a retreat and maybe a year or two later, I ran into this man, Steve, at one of these events. And I remember the moment he turned around and he said, "Oh, hi, Steve." And this, you know how some stories just mean a lot to you? I'm from New York City. If people met you once, they don't know who you are. Your name, the default name is Yo. Yo! That was my name at the boys' club. Yo! And you don't have a name. You're just that person. I vaguely recognize you. And that was my life till that point. That was my experience with anybody outside my family or outside those in my inner circle was my name's Yo. And this man just turned to me in the middle of this crowd of kids. I wasn't a leader. I was a nobody. I was 15 maybe at the time. And he looked at me and he said, "Oh, hi, Steve." And a tear began to stream down my cheek. I didn't even know what was happening. And I was from the hood. You don't cry in the hood. This involuntary response from deep inside of me came. And it was because somebody remembered my name. Somebody actually cared enough about me to know my name. And I looked at him, and I'm sure he saw my eyes glazing over, and he said, "You all right?" I said, "How'd you remember my name? I haven't seen you in months or years, and there's hundreds of us here. How did you know my name?" And I'll never forget what he said. He looked me in the face. He said, "Steve, the God of heaven not only knows your name, but he knows how many hairs are on your head. He knows everything that's ever happened in your life. He knows how many days you're going to live, and he loves you." And I believed him. He didn't preach the gospel to me. He didn't share anything but that. There was something about knowing that the God of heaven knows me that made me want to get to know him. And I believe that all of us have had some of those kind of encounters with God where it becomes intimate, where it's no longer just, do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God? Do you believe in your heart that God raised him from your dead? And will you confess it with your mouth? Where it goes beyond belief. And it comes to a matter of we have a God who is very much alive, who's very intimate and whose entire bent, his entire desire, the motive of everything that he does is to draw us back to himself. To have that intimate, no walls between, no need for a mediator, no need for somebody to explain it to you. But it's just me and my God. And when we get to that place and we live life in such a way that we walk in that place, then everything changes. Everything, every conflict and struggle, every source of anxiety, every thing that gets in our way, even though it's the same situation, it just looks very different from that perspective. Every anxiety, every fear, every, you know, what am I going to do with my life? Where am I going to go? What am I going to do next? What about these relationships that are falling apart? What about this job that I hate? All of these things, they just somehow take on a whole different perspective when we're walking with Daddy. And there's this thing that God desires to do, and it's not give us all the answers to everything as if, you know, he's like a dictionary or something like that. What do I do about this situation? Okay, bang, got it. I Googled it. Now I know what to do. God's not Google. He's intimate. His entire desire is, well, just walk with me. Like Jesus said to those two, come and see. You don't even have the capacity to understand what to ask the right questions right now. So just come and see. Just trust me. Just walk with me and you'll find out. So we have this amazing story that happened at the resurrection that John records. And after this horrific day, you know, all of the apostles in their own way and many of the disciples that walked close with Jesus experienced the crucifixion. Some of them were right there, like the author of the gospel, John, was right there for the crucifixion. He saw it all happen. They all saw Jesus crucified. They saw him dead, and they all knew what tomb he was laid in. They knew that he was dead and gone, and there wasn't a one who understood it yet. Not a one. Every one of them either fled or lived that day in confusion. Can you imagine that? The longest 3 days of their lives were in the midst right now. And we know through the other gospels that Jesus appeared to people and, you know, he just sort of popped up. He walked with two guys on the road to Emmaus and they walked with him all day and they didn't know who he was until he broke bread at the end of the night. And then their eyes were open and said, oh my goodness, we were talking to Jesus all day. We didn't know it. But our hearts were burning on the inside of us, they said. There was something going on the inside. And if only we knew how to pay attention to that burning in our hearts, we would have recognized, hey, something's different about this conversation and this man than everybody else out there. But all of them were confused. So they came to the tomb Sunday morning. And John, of all of the stories that he could have zeroed in on, he chooses Mary from Magdala, Mary Magdalene. She was a woman who all we really know about her for sure is that Jesus delivered her from 7 demons. So this woman was messed up. She had, as we sometimes say in deliverance ministry, a whole cast of characters working up on in there. And she didn't know which way was up when she met Jesus. However he did it, the miracle's not described in the scriptures, just mentioned. However Jesus did it, he set her free from 7 demons. And she was in her right mind, and she loved him with a passion. She was at the cross. She was one of the first ones to the tomb. It says, as we'll read in a moment, before the sun even came up. And her love motivation was confused, as you'll see in a moment, but said, I just still need to be near where he is because I have nowhere else to go now. I know the one who set me free. I'm in desperate confusion right now about what just happened. I don't get it. Nobody knew. Some of them were beginning to think maybe we were wrong. Maybe we just wasted the last 3 years of our lives and now he's dead and gone. Some were ready to pack it in and quit. Mary was there at the tomb, and we'll start here in verse 1. On the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came early to the tomb while it was still dark and saw the stone had already been taken away from the tomb. So she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved. That was John, the author of this gospel. And said to them, they've taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him. So her initial understanding of what's going on with this empty tomb, somebody must have stolen the body. That may seem crazy to all of us because we, with 2,000 years of hindsight and 4 gospels worth of information, how many times did Jesus have to say it? I mean, he spelled it out straight up. I'm going to be handed over to sinful men. They're going to crucify me and I'm going to rise on the 3rd day. take down this temple, metaphorically speaking, this temple, and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. He said it over and over again, but not a one of them understood. And here's the reason why. Because our tendency in life is to approach God eating from that second tree in the garden. Remember, there were two trees in the Garden of Eden. There was the tree of life, without which we can't be sustained. We were not created to be immortal. We were created to live forever dependent on the tree of life. We now know that tree of life is Christ himself. We now know that we were created not to live as immortal, independent people, but to live out of a life flow that comes from God himself. So there was that tree in the garden, and God's intention was eat from this tree and any other tree in the garden except for this one. One tree in the garden. Don't touch it. For in the day that you eat of it, it really says in the Hebrew, in dying you shall die. You're going to invite things into your life that I don't intend for you. I intend for you to have life, to enjoy this garden. Man and woman, naked and not ashamed in a garden with no children in paradise. It doesn't get better than that. They were set up to have life. And then there's this other tree called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. What's wrong with knowing good and evil? What could God possibly have a problem with his son and daughter, with Adam and Eve, knowing in their own lives how to distinguish the difference between good and evil and knowing good and evil? Well, the simple answer is we have a choice in life to live trusting and faith-filled toward God, or to live based on our own internal resources and our own understanding. We can live life saying, God, I love you, I trust you, wherever you're going, that's where I go. Or we could live life saying, God, as soon as you explain which way we're going, then I'll come with you, because I know good and evil, and I need to be able to discern it myself. Is this making sense? It's like we can choose to just say, God, you're God, and I'm the created one here. And if you say going that way is going to be my best life, that's really all I need to know, if you say so. What's your voice saying to me right now? What are you calling me into? Because wherever you go, that's going to be amazing. Or we can choose and say, as soon as you give me a roadmap, I want step-by-step directions from point A to point B. And as soon as I understand it and agree with you that that's the best way to go. Are there any marriages where both husband and wife are good with directions? Usually in marriage, it's one or the other, so this isn't an argument. But if both actually know where they're going, that can be harder, actually, sometimes. That's not the right way to go. My brother and I are like this when we get in a car together. We just did this in New York City. We're both native New Yorkers. We both know all the roads like the back of our hand. So we're trying to get from Staten Island to his house in Whitestone, arguing over the right way to go because we both know the roads. You know what I'm talking about? So it gets worse, actually, the more you know, the less likely you are to just, as we call it, blindly trust the Lord. You know, how many of you know there's no such thing as blind faith? If God's God, there's no such thing as blindly following him. It's just dumb not to follow him. If he's actually God, how dumb is it to say, I know better than you how to get there? So it'd be like somebody who has no clue where they're going, arguing with the GPS. That's not the right way to get there. And taking the wrong turn while the GPS patiently says, recalculating. Isn't that how we usually live? Come on, let's get real. We live based on eating from that other tree. No, I know how to get there. Even sometimes, this is why I think God doesn't always prophetically tell us where we're supposed to go. Because we'll think, well, now that I know where to go, I know how to get there too. So we shut the GPS off. I actually do this. I shut the voice on my GPS off because it drives me crazy. And 1,000 feet, turn left. And 990 feet, turn left. But we do that sometimes with the very voice of God and how we follow him. And we say, I'll go, but show me the map and let me agree with you that that's the right way to get there. And that's the difference between those two trees. So Mary's here at an empty tomb, and she has no grid for Jesus being raised from the dead. She has no concept that he actually went into that tomb, scourged and crucified, and that he's ever going to come out of there alive again. She has no grid for it. So immediately she goes, somebody must have taken his body. Somebody stole my love's body. And she's apoplectic. So she runs back and she gets Peter and John, it says. So Peter and the other disciple went, and they went to the tomb. The two were running together. I love this. John wrote the gospel, and he had to include the detail that the other disciple ran ahead faster than Peter and got to the tomb first. That's the advantage of being the author. That's the advantage of having the mic. You get to say whatever you want. Nobody can answer you back. So he got there first, but he stayed outside. It says that Peter, John stopped and looked in. He saw the linen wrappings lying there, but he didn't go in. Peter, however, man of action, he gets there. He came. Okay. And he goes right into the tomb to see what was going on. He saw the same thing. The linen wrappings were lying there. The face cloth, which had been on his head, were separated. So it had the appearance of somebody got up, took off his head wrapping, took off, you know, how many of you know we talked about Lazarus, how the crowd had to take off his grave clothes. Jesus took off his own. He just got up and said, oh, come on. Why'd you wrap me up? I told you I'd be out in 3 days. Took them all off, laid them on the side, and they were rolled up. So the other disciple, John, also entered. He saw and believed. He saw and believed. You know what's amazing about all of the original disciples? This ought to at least put us at rest about one thing. Every one of them needed evidence before they believed. There's not a record of a single one that believed just because they were told Jesus rose from the dead. Jesus had to show up, sometimes even say, touch me. In fact, Thomas got the bonus feature. Not only will you touch me, but go ahead and put your hand right in my side. You know, you want to touch me? Here you go. Stick your hand in there, Thomas. How many of you know you will never forget that? Putting your hand in the side of a man who was pierced with a spear, now risen from the dead. Anyway, blessed are those who have not believed and yet seen, right? All of them needed some evidence. So John saw and he believed. What did he believe? We don't know yet. He believed that, well, all right, he's not here. Maybe he was beginning to believe that he actually had risen from the dead. But where is he? He leaves. They both leave. They didn't understand the scripture. He has to rise from the dead. And it says in verse 10, so the disciples went away again to their own homes. That's a detail that many times we skip over in the story. They didn't all run back to the upper room for prayer. John and Peter, at least, having seen the empty tomb, went home. We don't have a grid for this. What's the point of standing around here in an empty tomb? We don't know what to make of this. Amazingly, I mean, most of you already know the rest of the story from either this or the other Gospels. There were angels in there ready to explain what was going on to anybody who'd stay and listen. They could have stuck around. They could have talked at least, but they just saw an empty tomb, had no grid for it, and moved right on. And here's something that they missed out on that Mary did not. And this is a truth. When something extraordinary happens, it's a real mistake to walk away just because we can't comprehend it. These are moments made by God for us to turn aside and listen carefully. Because little did they know that Jesus was actually standing right outside the tomb at this point. Mary would soon get to talk to him. I imagine sometimes like Peter and John, they're in there, the men, right? The two lead apostles, and they're talking and they're confused and then they walk out. I just picture Jesus just kind of sitting there in the garden and go, hey guys, and they just walk on their way talking among themselves, and there's Jesus risen from the dead waiting to talk with them. Do you not see that way? You guys are giving me that stone face look. Jesus is right there, but they don't know what to do, so they just leave. There was a moment, the turning point of Moses' life, when he was in Midian working as a shepherd for his father-in-law, Jethro. And after close to 40 years, wherever toward the end of his tenure there, a bush was on fire on the side of the mountain, but it wasn't consumed. Now, how many of you know that Moses could have looked at that burning bush, saw it's interesting, and just kept going on his way, shepherding the sheep? But because it says he turned aside and he said in his heart, I must see what this is all about. There's something extraordinary going on over here. And if I don't stop, I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight if I don't find out why this bush is on fire. And it seems obvious now because we look back and say, oh my goodness, there was an angel in that bush and God was going to talk to Moses through that bush. There was an empty tomb there and the disciples just came and they saw no body in it. Weren't they even at least a bit curious to stick around and explore it a little bit? And we can judge them like that, but how many times have you and I walked by something extraordinary, but we had places to go, We had an appointment on our day timer. We had things that we needed to tend to. And there was God in what, in hindsight, is obvious. Hey, guys, look over here. I'm doing something. I want to talk to you right now. I'm getting your attention. And we move on with our day as if nothing happened. The reason why these stories made it into the Bible is because somebody stopped when they saw those things and said, I got to see what this is about. This is too important right now for me to go on and finish doing my chores for the day. My honey-do list can wait. And I'll face the wrath of my wife if I need to. And by the way, it's not that way in my house. My wife doesn't ever make a honey-do list for me. She's very gracious with that stuff. Very patient. Just to make sure you know that. When we fail to stop in our tracks when God's trying to get our attention, we're at the greatest risk of missing out on the most awesome things in life. In this case, they could have saved themselves hours or maybe days worth of anguish. Where's Jesus? Because he was right there ready to talk to them. But as always, Jesus waits for us. After he comes to us first, he always initiates contact with us. After that, it's almost like he says, okay, tag, you're it. Keep following me. Keep up. I'll walk at a pace where you can keep up with me, but I'm not going to stop all the time. I want you to follow now. These two went home. Mary stayed, and it says Mary was standing outside the tomb weeping. Why was she weeping? Well, at this point, she thought somebody stole Jesus' body. She came with the express purpose of anointing his body. And they would do that for the first week after a burial. Every day, they would come, other than the Sabbath, they would come and anoint the body with spices to care for it. It was an expression of love towards somebody, usually a family member, or it could be for a close friend. It was a way of ministering to that person, even though they're dead and gone at that point in time. It was their way of honoring the one who had gone, an expression of love. So Mary, even in her heartbreak, even having seen the crucifixion, she said, I'm still going to go and anoint his body. I'll go with the other Marys, and it was all women who were going to do this on this morning. I'm going to go and express my love to him, even though I don't understand what just happened. Even though this was the greatest heartbreak of my life. Even though right now I don't even want to get out of bed in the morning, her love for Jesus compelled her to get up before the crack of dawn and go to anoint his body. So she was weeping and she stooped and looked into the tomb. And there were two angels in there this time. John and Peter didn't see these angels. They were probably in there. And for whatever reason, they didn't notice them or their eyes were veiled. We don't know. One was at the head and one was at the feet where the body of Jesus had been lying. And they said to her, woman, why are you weeping? I mean, this is like us looking back. Why are you crying? Jesus rose from the dead. You know what happens? You know how this ends? Not in that moment they did it. You know, we read the Bible and we listen to other people's testimonies with that 20/20 hindsight because we know how this turns out in the end. But how many of you know the tricky part is when you're in the middle of the test that comes before the testimony to be able to stay in faith? To be able to remain joyful, to stay toward the Lord in the middle of it. That's where rubber meets the road. And that's where we decide, will we have a great and glorious testimony at the end of the day? Or will this be another one of those tragic stories? You know, we're in the middle of a great story. This is one of my favorite little speeches in The Lord of the Rings. It comes, Frodo and Sam are talking. And they recognize we're caught up in a huge story that's way bigger than us. And then they're wondering, is this one of those hero stories that they're going to be singing around fires for generations to come? Or is this one of those tragic stories where the hero dies and is mourned? And they don't know at that point. How many of you know we already know the end of our story? We don't know how many days our story will have here on this planet Earth as it is right now, but we already know the end of our story and its life and that more abundantly. I'll be redundant even though I was called out for it. I've shared this before. You know, with Netflix now, the age of Netflix, you can binge watch TV shows. So my wife and I will catch shows. She actually likes some action shows we watch together. And, you know, when you start watching it, like we watched 24, right, when that series came out. We loved it. I mean, I was shocked my wife enjoyed that. And we'd stay up, I'll confess, sometimes till like 4 o'clock in the morning because, you know, they always, you know, and you can see the little clock, it's ticking down and the bomb's going to go off in 10 seconds, but there's only 7 seconds left in the episode. You're like, we can't stop now. So you watch the next one. But anyway, you binge watch it, and in every episode, Jack Bauer is going to die. I mean, dude, it's just over and over again, except you know that there's seven seasons of this show. Right? So it's a well-made movie, so it draws you in, but look, obviously he survives. See, if we could live life with that view and remember, we already know the end of our story, and the fact is, it's endless. Right? No matter what happens, the worst thing that could happen is right now could be your last day, right? That's how we tend to view life carnally. From the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that's got to be the most evil thing that could happen to somebody as they die. But when we have all of eternity in our hearts to consider, it's not the worst thing that could happen personally. I mean, I'd be sad about leaving behind my family, my kids. That would break my heart. All of you, I would miss you till I got to see you in glory. I mean, you know, it would be like that. But honestly, is that really bad? I almost feel bad for the devil sometimes. Like, go ahead, do your worst. If I die, great. If I live, great. Come on. So she says to the angels, they've taken away my Lord. I don't know where they've laid him. So she's still in this mind, like his body's got to be somewhere. And I've got to find a way to go and minister to his body. I'm going to still pour out my love on him. What the anguish of her heart isn't just the offensive, you know, body thieves that may have taken his body somewhere, or the, you know, whoever would have done something like that. It was that she came to express her love to Jesus and she couldn't do it right now. So in the chaos and confusion of particularly in traumatic events, it can be difficult even to perceive that God's up to something extraordinary. But it's our refusal to quit ministering to the Lord that keeps us toward him, toward these moments and hours of decision. Like this for Mary was a moment of decision. She could have left like the two men did, and that would have been the end of it. But there was a desire in her heart to minister to the Lord. The secret to walking through those difficult seasons of life when everything seems to be falling apart is not to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and say, God, I need an answer, I need a solution. The secret to ministering and apprehending what God has for us in that is to keep our heart toward him and keep pouring out our love, to keep worshiping him, to keep sacrificing our lives toward him, to keep moving in his direction, because he has something in store. He always does. God is the author and the finisher of our faith, and he's not the author of tragedies. He doesn't write those stories. It's only when we hijack the narrative and shipwreck our lives that we end up in tragedy. God's the ultimate romance novel guy. It always ends with, and they lived happily ever after. That's always the end of his story. So when we turn our hearts to him in the middle of tragedy, in the middle of chaos and confusion, and say, I don't need to understand. I'm not going to take another bite from that stinking tree and require you to give me understanding. I want to eat from the tree of life. So that I, whatever comes next, never lose you in the midst of it. That's the secret to life. So Mary stays, and when she said that, she turned around, and there was Jesus standing there. And she didn't know that it was Jesus. This is one of the most amazing moments in the Bible for me, because this is a woman who knew him well. All of his disciples knew him well. Do you know that not a one of them, you could read through all the resurrection accounts, nobody recognized Jesus after he rose from the dead. And yet, he was in the same body somehow. There was something about his body that he could say, touch my scars, put your hand in my side, and yet nobody could recognize him because it was his glorified resurrection body, he being the first fruits of those who rise from the dead. So Mary, one of his best friends, looking right at him, and it says she looked at him, and Jesus said to her, woman, why are you weeping? Like the angels did. Well, what are you crying about? I don't know. I think Jesus has a great sense of humor, and I think he had a smirk on his face. Like, girl, if you only knew who you're talking to right now, you'd be dancing and jumping and shouting. But he's withholding, revealing himself yet. So who are you seeking? And it says, supposing him to be the gardener. The thing about Jesus is that he's always showing up in a way that we don't recognize him at first. Every time he becomes predictable, he's not him anymore. Then nobody that God ever showed up to who knew what was coming next. And nobody recognized Jesus. All of his chosen people missed him because they were expecting a mighty conqueror. They were expecting this Messiah who would conquer Rome and drive out the pagans out of the promised land. They were looking for that. But Isaiah already told them 500 years before he came, he had no shapely form or majesty that we should be drawn to him. He was going to come in a way that Jesus could have sat in the middle of our church service right now. None of us would have known it was him till he revealed himself somehow. And Mary was about to find out that he's still the same way. That he doesn't come in this obvious way. How many of you before you got born again or maybe since have said to God, why don't you just show yourself to the whole world? Have you ever done that? I've been frustrated with Jesus sometimes as I'm trying to minister to somebody and, you know, see if I could open up their eyes to maybe the deception of not believing the way that we do. And I get frustrated. I'm like, Jesus, wouldn't it have been easier for you just to go on a world tour after you rose from the dead? Get some eyewitnesses, like maybe that centurion who was there to crucify you, and do a tour and say, look, guys, I was crucified. Now I'm resurrected. Believe in me right now. And then you read the Gospels and you realize, man, they ain't going to believe anyway. Risen from the dead, people were still trying to squelch the story, and that's why they persecuted the church. It still wasn't going to make a difference because he wants to show up in a way that doesn't come from that second tree. If you need proof, if you need evidence, if it all has to make sense in the mind before your heart can respond to what it already knows, then it's from the wrong tree. It's not of faith. It's not what God intended in the first place. It's us back in the driver's seat of our life saying, I believe you because you proved it to me beyond my reasonable doubt. That's a reversal of roles. That's us in the God seat and God in the whatever seat. Let me prove myself to you. And he doesn't sit in that seat for very long. He doesn't like it in that seat. So there's Jesus and he looks like a gardener. I was wondering, why the gardener? You know, they have like overalls on, pruning shears in his hand or something like that. Why the gardener? And then I thought, and I think I've preached this here, so I'll be redundant again today. You made me paranoid about that now. The first Adam's job in the garden, all he had to do before sin came into the picture was care for the garden and keep it. And so the last Adam rose from the dead, and just like the first Adam, he looked around and he said, man, we got a lot of weeding to do here. My garden's gotten all messed up. You guys have wrecked this whole place. And he came out ready to do that. But anyway, she thought he was the gardener. And she said to him, sir, if you've carried him away. Now she's accusing Jesus of stealing his own body. If you've carried, which is true in a sense. If you've carried him away, tell me where you've laid him and I'll take him away. Do you hear her desperation? She does. It's not so much about he's not in the place where I lay him. I want to care for him. My love for him is making me seek after him. And even in the midst of my pain and confusion, I've got to know where he is. And then Jesus turns to her. Now all of this, she's having this conversation with the risen Lord. And here's how he opened her eyes. Jesus just said to her, he's already talked, so it wasn't because she recognized his voice. Jesus said to her, Mary. Called her name. Something about the way that he said her name that opened her eyes. This is my love. That this is Jesus. I'm asking questions in our conversation, even seeing him, and that didn't convince me. But something about the way that he said her name made her open her eyes, and she said to him, Rabboni, which means teacher. It's actually the intimate form of the word rabbi. It doesn't just mean teacher. It means, oh, my teacher. My love. My Lord. I didn't recognize you before. But now that you've called me by name like you did when you cast those demons out of me, now that you've touched me the same way you did when you awakened my soul to the one I love, to the one that I was made for, oh, now I recognize you. She still looked like a gardener to her in the natural, but something in her heart began to sing. And there's this reset button that God's given to us. So when we get into a condition like, as the book of Revelation describes the Ephesian church, where we become lukewarm. Lukewarm simply means you become dead. We don't feel anything. That's what lukewarm refers to. Jesus said you're better off cold, which would be more the picture of you're hostile toward God. I'm an atheist. I'm an unbeliever. Red hot for the Lord means I'm passionate, I'm in love, I'm going to live for His glory, I'm going to pursue Him with my whole life. Lukewarm means I'm totally dead, I don't feel anything toward God right now. Whether He exists or not doesn't even actually practically matter on a day-to-day life. It's when the answer to that question I've posed to all of those I disciple to be a good heart check. Like if you could say, what would happen if Jesus was totally removed from my life tomorrow? What would change about how my day would go? If the answer to that question is not much, we're in a lukewarm condition. It's a dangerous place to live. If the answer to that question is, I'd rather not take another breath until I have Him again, then we're in a good place. The great news today is that it's as simple as staying. She just stayed put because her heart refused to just walk away from this empty tomb. Her heart refused to let go. Even though I don't know where He is, even though I'm totally confused, I know that I've got to find Him. I'm going to seek Him, and I'm going to find Him if it's the last thing I do. I can't just go back to everyday life. I've got to find Him. And the good news about us is that we have this reset button in our life, and it comes when we pause long enough to hear Him call us by name. The solitude is the spiritual discipline, as it's called. When we sit still long enough, I read a book recently, it's got a great picture of this. If you have a bunch of silt in a jar with water and you shake it up, that's normally how we go about our life. We're so busy and running around. I should have had one of those here, but it would take too long to settle to be an object lesson anyway. We're so shaken up and all the silt gets up, right, and the whole jar looks muddy. And the only way to be able to see through the water again is to sit that jar still and leave it alone. And it could take a few minutes, it could take a few hours, depending on the weight of the sediment, before it all settles back down again. And sometimes the reason why we can't hear God or perceive His presence in our lives is that we're so dang busy running around. We're in our mind trying to make sense of something that doesn't make sense to us. We're so busy doing for God or, you know, doing whatever we think we're supposed to be doing that we don't even sit still long enough to just hear Him say our name in that special way that makes us know that's the only place I want to be. I know that my God knows me, and I really just want to be with Him right now. When we stop seeking God with our minds alone, then our hearts are awakened to His reality. We see Him as He is, and then we can recognize what we're doing, what He's doing. We remember that He called us by name, and we're His. There's this precious promise that God gave through the prophet Isaiah when Israel was entering a season of judgment. They were about to be overrun by enemies, their promised land completely ravaged, people taken away captives and slaves, and Isaiah prophesied a lot of judgment. And it's the most incredible, it's my favorite of the Old Testament prophets, because there's all this judgment, and yet some of the most beautiful promises, some of the most eloquent expressions of God's love for His people, His steadfast love. That even though this is happening right now, oh boy, you're going to forget that compared to the restoration I'm going to do after it's over. You're going to forget that you even ever had an exile out of the promised land compared to how I'm going to love you when it's all said and done. And so He gives this promise in the middle of judgment, but now says, thus says the Lord your Creator, O Jacob, and He who formed you, O Israel, don't fear, for I've redeemed you. I have called you by name. And you're mine. There's a reason why we name our children. And it's not so that when they're in trouble, we know which one to call to ourselves. We name our children because it gives them an identity. Fathers and mothers have authority to name their children. Because from that day onward, that voice will be their reset button. For all the days of growing up, all those first 18, 25 years, however long it takes, of growing up, the voice of the one who named you is your permanent reset button. When a parent calls their child, even if it's for discipline or some kind of, you know, the thing that's going on that needs to be corrected, it's always for the purpose, I'm going to reset you right now. So our relationship is right, so you could live right and enjoy life and that to the full. Or if it's just, hey, come on, I'm calling you by your name right now because we're going to go out in the yard and play catch. We're going to go out in the yard and play, you know, we're going to tickle or we're going to do whatever, play on the swing together. That's our reset button. And if we haven't heard the voice of God calling us by name, and that means in such a way, whatever God does, how many know He's very clever at knowing how to penetrate through even our stony hearts. He knows how to communicate with us in a way that we know, oh, that was God. You all know what I'm talking about? It's that, you know, it's in the category of the peace that goes beyond understanding. It's not that I came to a mental assent that, yes, that must be God, because that was too big of a coincidence, so it had to be God. It's not like that. It's the kind of thing where you just know, like what just happened to me when I got to that verse, and it's happening again, that I know that there are moments that I know have been known by the God of the universe. The good news in the whole life with God is not just that we would know Him, but that He would know us. That's the good news. That He knows us. And so I've called you by name, and you're mine. So life's just going to be all a bed of roses now, and everything's just going to be hunky-dory from this point onward. Oh, no, it's not. We're still here, and we still have a commissioning here. We're still called to bring heaven down to earth because somebody's squatting on the throne of God in this earth, the devil, and he's usurped the authority that was given to us to have dominion on kingdom of heaven's behalf here in the world. That, by the way, is a summary of that 10-week course I'm about to teach. So he says, look, when you pass through the waters, not if you pass through the waters, waters in this case are not the living waters you drink from. These waters are like a flash flood that drowns you and wipes out your town. That's what these waters refer to. I'm going to be with you. When you go through the rivers, they're not going to overflow you. When you walk through the fire, not if you walk through the fire, when you walk through the fire, you ain't going to be scorched. Sorry, I went New Brooklyn translation there for a second. And the flame won't burn you. I'm going to be with you. No matter what happens, remember that I've called you by name. You're mine, and nothing will ever change that. Because you didn't choose me, Jesus said. I chose you, and I would choose you all over again. I'll choose you on that day when you did that dirty thing. I choose you on that day when you just about killed the one that you love. I choose you on the day that you are so ashamed of yourself that you wish you could just hide somewhere and nobody will ever find you again. I choose you. You didn't choose me, but I chose you, and I appointed you to go and bear much fruit. So Jesus, hit that reset button in our hearts. Make us to be a people that can hear again your voice, calling us like you did at the first, calling us your sons and your daughters, and to know with everything in our being that at the sound of that voice, life and that more abundantly is going to be my portion. That at the sound of that voice, restoration's only a turning of the heart away. At the sound of that voice, hope is going to be restored in the most hopeless area of my life. At the sound of that voice, the thing I thought was impossible all of a sudden begins to look perfectly possible, even probable. Actually, it's absolutely going to be. Jesus, awaken us. Settle the silt in our lives. I pray, even as I prayed earlier, I want to pray again. Give each and every one of us opportunity to sit quietly in your presence and receive this ministry from you, that we every day hear the voice of the Father in heaven saying, this is my beloved Son, this is my beloved daughter, in whom I am well pleased. Amen. Amen. If you could use some prayer to reawaken that in you, I'm going to ask the altar team and the elders to be down here in the front with me. Come and get some prayer. And ask, we'll ask on your behalf together with you that God would remove whatever veil, whatever thing's been separating you from that experience. Let's go to the Lord with it and let's pray. For the rest of you, God bless you. Have a great week. In Jesus, I hope to see you at 2 o'clock at the Hoffman's house at the picnic. We're going to have a great time together there. And I love you guys. God bless you. Have a great day.